Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY. This is the morning show with Chris and Susie, and I'm Susie Prez, and I have my co-host over here, Chris Bessler. You know, Chris, I haven't seen you for a while. How you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, I had a couple weeks off there, Susie. You carried on ably.
Well, that's good. Yeah. And it is Wednesday, December 5th. And what else do we need to know about today?
There's, of course, a lot of stuff going on in our town. Today, we're going to be talking with Sean Keough. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
And you are just leaving your position as Idaho State Senator after 22 years.
That's right. Friday, November 30th, was my last day.
Last day on the rolls there. For the record, you are the longest-serving female state senator in Idaho history. So you are a historic personage sitting before us.
Very honored and humbled by that, yes.
It is so nice to have you here. And just, you know, as a celebratory moment here on the airwaves of 88.5, we've had you in before, but we really just want to thank you for your years of service here for District 1.
Thank you.
And we're going to come back and get your whole story here in just a little bit. We want to talk about, you know, how you got into it and some of the things that happened during your long tenure there and take a peek what you might prognosticate would be coming up in the future for the state and some of the issues it faces. So we're going to have some interesting talk there.
I also want to mention that today is the National Day of Mourning to honor the 41st U.S. President George H.W. Bush, who has passed away. It is his funeral day, and federal buildings will be closed.
Yes. Yeah, and flags are at half-mast, actually. The state funeral is actually in process right now over in Washington, D.C. Other things going on around town, Susie? Anything leap to mind for you?
88.5 KRFY really wants to thank everyone who came out to our annual meeting and Idaho Poor Authority fun party that we had last Wednesday. So thanks to the community, we are moving forward. It is a supported radio station by our listeners and our community. So we just want to say thank you.
Yes, we do want to say thank you. We can't do it without the folks that do support the radio. Other things going on there, Toys for Tots has kicked off. That's always a big effort here in town. If you are in a family or know of a family that could use some help this Christmas with Christmas toys for their children, the Sandpoint Lions Club is accepting Toys for Tot applications on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at their clubhouse at 609 South Ella. And, of course, donating to the Toys for Tots is a very nice Christmas charitable gesture to be making as well. There are all kinds of places around town to do that. Take a look at the Daily Bee because they have a daily update on the Toys for Tots campaign. A very worthwhile
endeavor. Tuesday, the morning show hosts will have Judy Dombrowski in talking about Toys for Tots.
And going on around town, a lot of holiday things. The Nutcracker film is going to be playing at the Panada. There's a Girls Night Out festive shopping event in downtown Sandpoint on Friday. There's breakfast with Santa Saturday at the Sandpoint Community Hall. The Lake Pontere High School Christmas Fair, that's the alternative high school, is having a Christmas fair on Saturday. There's art receptions happening at Artworks and the Pondere Gallery. A lot of holiday things going on. And if you want to see more details on those, go to our calendars at krfy.org or go to Sandpoint Online, which provides those calendars. Susie, we should back up and say what's happening weather-wise.
Well, from the National Weather Service, we have currently 28 degrees outside. Becoming sunny today. I see a lot of sunshine in the little pictures they put across the screen. And high today of 31. And light winds, 5 to 9 miles per hour. Tonight, patchy freezing fog after 10 p.m. with a low tonight of 15. Tomorrow, pretty much the same as today. Patchy freezing fog in the morning and then sunny, high of 31. And that looks like it's all the way across the week. So that's pretty much what we're looking at for our weather this week.
A few other things going on outside. The sunrise was at 7:19 a.m. this morning. It'll set at 3:52 this afternoon. I can't even say this evening. We're hitting the shortest day of the year. It's only a couple of weeks away now, the 21st, which means every day after that will be getting longer. So that's always something to celebrate, the winter solstice. Up in the skies, there's always interesting things happening in the skies because we have these long, dark days here. But if you go out at night, there's some cool things to see. Right now, Venus has a really dazzling morning star that shows up with a lot of brilliance. It's high in the sky at pre-dawn. If you have good weather, that's a good one to check out. There's also a comet called 46P that's going to become increasingly visible. It's not nearly as big as the Hale-Bopp was in the 1990s, but it is visible to the naked eye. And you might go out and Google that so you can see where to see that in the sky, because that's kind of an interesting thing when a comet comes swinging by our little planet here.
Well, you keep us up to date as that gets closer and closer.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be reach us at the closest point in about 2 weeks. So
okay.
It should be getting a little brighter over that period of time.
All righty. Well, let's get to our interview. What do you think, Chris?
Yes.
Okay. Again, Sean Keough, our retired state senator for District 1, which is North Idaho. Again, thank you for being here, and thank you for your years of service.
And Sean, a little bit of history on you for the folks that may not know it, but you were a first elected senator for District 1. That includes Boundary County, most of Bonner County in 1996, and you've served now 22 years. Mm-hmm. Again, okay. That makes you the longest serving female state senator in Idaho history. I have no idea. Do you know what the next closest is?
For state senate? No, I don't. In the House, Maxine Bell would have been the longest serving female representative, I believe.
And about how long has she been serving? You know?
She actually was close to 30 years.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, you graduated from Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati, Ohio. You came to Idaho in 1979. You've attended North Idaho College and Lewis Clark State College studying business management. You've been executive director of the Associated Logging Contractors since 2000. And during your long tenure in the Senate, you've achieved some pretty important and influential chairmanships. You're chairman, have been up to now, chairman of the Finance Committee.
Yes.
And a co-chair of the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, and you're also on the Transportation Committee.
Correct.
And we're going to swing around on what committee assignments mean and how that helps your constituents here to draw a good committee assignment a little bit later on in our questions. But I thought we'd start at the start. What brought you to Idaho these many years ago?
Growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is a pretty big Midwestern city, heavily populated, although they have a wonderful park system. I just wanted to get out west into the wide open, and I wanted to be a forester when I grew up. Came from a broken home and been living on my own since I was 16. And so I just wanted to get out of Cincinnati and go west, and met some folks from Sandpoint and thought, well, what the heck? And so so landed here in 79, attracted by the four seasons, skiing in particular at that time, and then all the activities in the summer around the lake. So.
And I actually remember probably early 80s that you were a bartender at the Donkey Jaw.
That's right. Yeah. My first job when I got to town that I had for 6 or 7 years was as a bartender at the Donkey Jaw. And I actually will share, and I've told others, that I learned everything I needed to know about public service as a bartender.
Because you hear it all, right?
Well, yeah. You hear it all. You learn how to serve people. You learn how to listen. You learn how to be stern when folks have had just one too many drinks. And so, and you learn a lot, meet a lot of good people.
Yeah, and the Donkey Jaw, for those that don't remember that, was where iCarts is currently.
That's right.
Yes, it was flopped. I think the
bar was upstairs. The bar's on top,
and there was dining downstairs.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, I remember working at the Waldorf School. It must have been 1996 because a very young senator came over and said, "I'm your state senator, Sean Keough, and I want to find out about your education that you have here. You're a new school, private school." And you came over and you introduced yourself, and you were very young but very enthusiastic. So the question really that I have is, what inspired you to first run for the state senate back in 1996, and had you held other elected office before?
Well, thank you for that question. At the time, I was working at the Sandpoint Chamber of Commerce and working with their governmental affairs committee, the Agriculture and Forestry Committee, and their timber program, and so was very involved in the business community and in the issues of the day. And then my husband, Mike, was a school teacher, and we also had, we have two boys, and they were young, and so I always felt a sense of obligation if I identified a problem to try to be part of the solution to a problem. And so I had no experience in elected office, but felt as though I needed to step up. I saw some things I thought needed to be addressed in our community better than they were. And so I thought I'd just jump into the ring and see if I could make a positive difference.
You must have had some encouragement.
I certainly had some folks that encouraged
key
me
individuals.
To run. Yes. Yes, yeah. Especially since the race was against an incumbent. Senator Tucker, Tim Tucker out of Bonners Ferry, was in the office at the time. Excuse me. And he had been in the Senate for a couple of terms, but he had also previously served in the House as well. So I think he had a total of 12 or 13 years at the time. And so that was a pretty significant leap. I actually had limited expectations of winning. My goal going into it was just to create a dialogue and opportunity for putting some issues on the table that I didn't feel like had been addressed.
And actually, you won by a pretty healthy margin.
I did. Yeah. I did.
I think it was 60-40.
It was.
Yeah, which was, at that point in time, was kind of a big thing because, believe it or not, a lot of the seats were held by Democrats. Actually, all the legislative seats at that time were held by Democrats. And Tim had been in there for, like you mentioned, 3.5 terms as a senator, before that a representative, so he was well-known. What do you recall about the experiences of running that first year, where you really got to push yourself out in ways that probably were brand new to you?
Definitely brand new. And I had a Republican primary challenge. County Commissioner Gene Brown at the time challenged in the primary. And so it was a different arena to run in. And then, of course, with Senator Tucker being the incumbent and someone who had served the community a long time, it seemed like a formidable task. But at the same time, it seemed also, apparently, judging by the ultimate vote of those who voted, sometimes I think that I just was in the right place at the right time, that there were other issues that the senator may not have been addressing. I guess I'm hopeful that my sales pitch, so to speak, of just bringing a fresh set of eyes and a different perspective and some more enthusiasm to the job apparently prevailed.
So. Did you knock on doors?
Definitely. Okay. Yes, definitely. A textbook campaign with first trying to secure successfully securing the Republican support in the primary, knocking on doors, reaching out to Republicans, fellow Republicans, and then mail and signs and community meetings, endless community meetings, and one-to-one meetings with people across the district.
Yeah, and did your campaigning style change over the years? Did it become easier for you to campaign? Actually, in the end, it probably became harder.
I think there was a bit of a bell curve there, or I'm not sure how that curve worked, but it was very labor intensive. Actually, most of the way through, because I always believed firmly in meeting as many people as possible, and going and being part of the community and being involved in meetings that were important to our folks here. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of commitment. And I continued that throughout. And so that pace throughout all my campaigns, the last three campaigns over the last 6 years really took on a different tone. Those were less about the specifics of our state legislature and what it can do, and more about philosophical ideology, and then personal attack politics.
Okay. Well, that was a learning process for you all the way along, and things are about always going to change, but how about the first term as state senator? What were some of the things that you had to learn right off the bat? And any stories come to mind from that first year or two as you were learning the ropes in Boise, or just a very young woman senator? And how was that? And what did you learn? And what did you need to gain to kind of get your foot in? And what were some of the maybe committees that you could get on in the beginning?
So I did feel as though I knew what the process was because of the involvement through the Chamber of Commerce and being involved in some of the issues that were important to the business community, had some interaction with legislators and gone to Boise a few times during the session. So it kind of felt like I understood the framework. Certainly, I was 36 years old, married with two young kids. And at the time, the Senate was predominantly older gentlemen, and whose culture did not support me being there. And so it took a while to gain their confidence and respect, and a lot of interpersonal communication and building some trust and opening some communication that was tough. However, once I was able to convince them that the kids were okay and the husband was totally supportive, and that obviously had the community support, they were really good to work with. There were a few humorous moments involved there in terms of trying to get them to understand that I really was the senator. So, in fact, I had, one of a funny story was at the time, each caucus, the Republican and the Democrat caucus, hires a communications person during the legislative session to help you do radio shows from Boise or get your message out to the voters at home. And I walked into that gentleman's office and said, hey, I'm here to work on constituent communications. And he looked at me and he said, who are you working for? Which senator? And to this day, he apologizes for that. He's like, I can't believe I did that. So just young and younger than everyone at that time and female. So that was different.
I just wonder if there is any one person, senator or congressperson, that kind of took you under their wing and kind of helped you find your footing.
So there were a couple of senators at the time. Senator Dean Cameron, who was just a few months older than me, was a mentor, as was Senator Judy Danielson out of the council area, and Senator Sheila Sorensen. All of them in the Republican caucus. And then Senator Marguerite McLaughlin out of Orofino, who was in Democratic leadership. I knew her because she was from a logging family. And So they were very helpful and supportive in helping me learn the ropes. So,
Your comments on the fact that when you came into the legislature, there were not very many women holding elective office. Has the composition of the Idaho chambers changed that much?
That has. There was a year when there were only two women in the 35-member Senate. I have not counted today, but there's it's still a disproportionate ratio, but I think there's at least 10, maybe 12.
And we're certainly seeing nationally many more women that are getting involved
definitely.
In politics.
Yeah. Definitely.
Your comments also about some of the mentors you had at the start made me wonder about making relationships and friends with folks you're serving with, and then all of a sudden they're not there because they lose an election. Is that a kind of a strange situation to be in?
There's certainly a transition there, but there is definitely a transition there, and things do change. But that's part of the legislative process that you have to adapt to. And also, we still have telephone. And
you can still be in touch with them.
And then when email emerged, we can still be in touch.
Yeah, you were talking about the pre-email days here, aren't we?
You know, I tell people that in 1996 through almost, 1999, 2000, I was writing letters and calling people. Yeah. No emails. I still have a stack of stationery, little notes. Definitely the communication changed. And that's good. The advent of the internet has made the process so much more accessible to us here.
Yes, and a lot of our listeners may not know it, but there is a very good state website for people to see what bills are coming up. And monitor the whole activity down there.
That's exactly right. And I encourage folks, if my takeaway message for today is to stay involved in legislature.idaho.gov. And you can watch all the committee proceedings. Tomorrow they'll be swearing the new legislature in. You can tune in if you have internet bandwidth. If not, you can go to the library. But you can email your legislators from there, look at all the bills. If you do have access to the internet at home, you can even build your own bill list of bills that are important to you and get updates on the activities there.
They'll just be emailed to you as things progress through the process, yeah.
Yeah. I know, that is fabulous. We're looking at this 22-year tenure that you've had. And so in the beginning, there were issues that were very important you campaigned on, things like that, and I'm sure they've changed and shifted. But when you look at what some of the legislation was that was important in the beginning is important now to North Idaho in particular. And then what are some of your biggest achievements on those issues?
Oh, well, thank you for that question. You know, the 22 years retrospective has given me some time to reflect and went into my decision, ultimate decision to step aside, and that a lot of our issues that were important then remain important today. And those key pieces I campaigned on early on were education and transportation and natural resource issues. And those broad categories are as important today. And they really haven't changed that much. We've made progress in education funding. We've made progress in building our roads. We've made progress on our natural resources as it relates to protecting our water quality and our lakes and taking care of some of our forest issues. But my naiveness at the time was I was going to fix all of that. But I have come to understand that it's always there. And if you look at history, that was there when we founded this state, and it'll be there long after we're all gone. Those issues just continue to be there in those categories, but the specifics on what you work on change. So I have been proud to have worked and moved the ball forward, so to speak, on securing funding for our K-12 schools. so that more funding's coming from Boise, relieving the need to ask for supplemental levies here at home. Being proud of my service on the budget committee when, during the economic downturn, I was able to work to shelter those K-12 budgets from cuts. We were able to put away some reserves, which we took a lot of criticism for, but those reserves helped cushion the K-12 budgets through the downturn. The higher ed that we have today here in our community, North Idaho College, Lewis Clark State College, ability for students to do their work here in Sandpoint or in Bonners Ferry, the fact that all of our institutions, including our four-year institutions, are located on a campus in Coeur d'Alene, I'm very pleased with being able to be a part of that. Our online learning opportunities, the opportunities for our high school students to graduate from high school and also graduate with an associate's degree. I'm proud to have been part of that. Road projects, working with George Eskridge on the Dover Bridge. We've done a lot of work on our roads across Legislative District 1.
Bypass comes to mind.
The bypass comes to mind.
That's a huge project. Yeah.
Huge project and a lot of controversy, as you know, and others do as well. But ultimately, I think it's an amazing structure. I don't think there's anything like it in the state in terms of the amenities,
like with the vegetated wall and the bike path.
The bike path. I really can't think of any other project in the state that has similar, and that's a reflection of community involvement.
And the community being really concerned about it. That was Sand Creek bypass was a point of contention here for quite a while.
Right.
Were some of the other guys down in the state like we're putting too much resource here make this thing fixed up like this?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. In fact, we had a legislative tour shortly after it opened, and fellow legislators said, "You're not getting any more money." and so, although we have been able to overcome that sentiment, it's definitely a sentiment in southern Idaho where there's so much money into the northern projects. And my response has always been, well, it's about time. You know, we were always behind, and we haven't caught up yet. Mm-hmm. So, but there is that constant tension, whether it's me or the next senator or the senator after that. There's always that advocacy that has to happen for our area.
If you're just tuning in, this is the morning show with Chris and Susie on 88.5 KRFY, and we're speaking this morning with outgoing State Senator Sean Keogh, who's just wrapping up her 22 years in the Idaho State Senate. Again, Sean, thanks for being here. One of the things we're talking about is, some of the big issues that have come to the fore over 22 years. One that occurs to me is, it seems like 22 years ago, our population was probably, the state population was probably well under a million. Mm-hmm. Now it's pushing 2 million, I think.
It's like 1.6, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we've seen a lot of growth in the state. It's actually one of the fastest growing states in the country. Consistently, of course, that's based on a percentage in absolute numbers. Some states probably grow more, but considering we're a small state and we're getting a lot of new arrivals, is that creating stresses for the state that the legislature has to deal with?
Certainly, population growth, particularly when it's centered in Idaho's urban areas. Like Coeur d'Alene, like Boise, in the Treasure Valley area, Twin Falls, Pocatello, Idaho Falls. It's causing growth challenges at a variety of levels. Transportation, more highways, particularly in the Treasure Valley. Coeur d'Alene's dealing with, they're not gridlock, LA style, but they're certainly gridlock.
Idaho style,
commute to Coeur d'Alene for my job with the logging contractors, and there's a steady stream during a rush hour in the morning and a rush hour at night. So those growth areas, housing, and what can and the role of the state in on that issue and affordable housing. Is there a role for the state legislature to play? And some would say yes in some policies, tax policies or other policies. There's also concern that land for agriculture is being turned into subdevelopments, and there's some concern about that from a perspective of agriculture and land conservation and also water. Many times up here in the north, we forget that southern Idaho is a desert and there's some huge water issues there. And we, too, will face our own form of water issues, already are, water management issues and water access issues. School funding, school buildings to accommodate the growth that we're seeing as well. So there are a variety of issues that the growth impacts at the state level, in addition to the local communities that have to deal with that.
I guess on the flip side, it does usually bring more revenue because there's more taxpayers paying taxes, right? And does the revenue that comes to the state keep pace with the need, do you think, that growth incurs?
Certainly, there is growth in revenue to the state through taxes, but what we're also seeing is a growth in retirees, and those folks may not be bringing economic growth with them, but yet you still have to provide the services, and although that's more felt at a local level than at a state level, that is also a piece of conversation about attracting and growing businesses in Idaho so that you can grow your economic activity and bring in tax revenue to support the infrastructure.
And the young workers that we need to carry things on. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about. Looking forward, forecasting and getting overviews. But we wanted to take a short break. And Sean, you had a song you wanted us to play because you want to introduce it and tell us a little bit about why you chose this song.
You bet. You asked me before we started about a song for the music break. And my husband and I were fortunate enough to go to Portland right before Thanksgiving and see Fleetwood Mac. And I can't remember the name of the song, but I sang a few bars of that tune, and I think Susie found it. But it's just a very uplifting song. Fleetwood Mac is an awesome band, in my view. They are still rocking into their 70s, and just a very uplifting and motivational concert and song.
And that song is Don't Stop. And, you could consider in your retirement becoming a music DJ.
No.
Anyways.
She's always recruiting, Sean. So.
We have Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop. We'll be back with retiring Senator Sean Keogh here on The Morning Show. Stay with us. And that was Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop. And we are live here in the KRFY studios. And we had a caller while we were having a break. And we're actually here with retiring State Senator Sean Keogh talking about state, your career. But we had a caller. So I'm just going to ask their question right now if you're okay with that.
That's great.
Okay. It was, is there a movement or what does it take to have Northern Idaho on the same time zone as Boise, Southern Eastern Idaho?
So there is actually continual discussion, and it's mostly been, in my time there, it's mostly been in the last 10 years, which is actually a pretty big span of time. But it also ends up being controversial. And the reason why is that there are many in this community that would like to be on the same time zone with Boise, Mountain Time. But there are also many in this community, primarily in the business community, that want to be in the same time zone as Spokane and Seattle and San Francisco and the West Coast and Pacific time zone. And their businesses surround that. And so therein is the divide statewide and within our within our own community here in Legislative District 1. Last legislative session, the Senate passed a resolution that should Eastern Washington change their time zone, which apparently was on the table at the time, that Idaho would all go into Mountain Time. I lost track of what happened to that over in the House. It was towards the end of the session. And I would imagine Senator Steve Vick out of Hayden, was his project. And I would imagine that he will bring that back and we will continue to have that discussion. And I'd encourage folks here in our district to let their legislators know what they think.
That's actually a complicated issue, though, because if we went to Mountain Time and right across the border in Spokane, where there's a lot of commerce that goes back and forth, there are people that work here, and we go to entertainment things, and they come here, we'd have that hour's difference with a pretty important part of our local culture.
Yeah, it is a huge impact, and while I understand the desire to be on the same time zone with Boise and Southern Idaho, it would have a huge impact to business and people that go across the border every day to work. So it's an issue. It is not easy.
Yeah. That actually touches on one of the questions we had here. About the differences between the northern and the southern parts of the state. Do you think, there's always been this feeling, there's this north-south divide, that Boise really doesn't pay attention to North Idaho, and because we're so far removed from them. It's an 8-hour drive. I mean, we're 8 or 9 hours, to get from one part of the state to the other. Do you think there is a north-south divide in this way, and that it's makes it more difficult for Northern Idaho to get their issues addressed?
So I think on some things there is. Our state is huge, and it's geographically huge, which is part of the challenge with the time zone. So I think because we can fly to Boise in an hour, I think we sometimes lose sight of how big this state really is. And then if you have to get to Idaho Falls, it takes a long time to get there. What I've seen over the years is that our issues tend to divide more on the issue itself, or less north-south and more along the lines of whatever the issue is, or a rural-urban split. So rural Idaho might feel one way, but urban Idaho feels a different way. So, for example, and just talking in generalities. So for the Treasure Valley, light rail is a huge issue right now. Public transportation is a huge issue. It's less so in rural Idaho. Funding for schools. Rural Idaho school districts have more issues in terms of bus transportation and the geography between the schools. In the rural Idaho and the lower populations, urban Idaho's dealing with growth, and their issues are less about the busing and more about the number of students that they have. And so that's been my observation. It's more splits along more ideology lines or urban versus rural than north-south.
Well, we want to move on just a little bit to current issues that started right here, actually, in Sandpoint. In this election, it was Proposition 2, which is Medicare expansion, as it's called. And in Bonner County, it passed with a 53% vote in favor. And statewide, it was 60% in favor. And recently, I think it was a couple weeks ago, the then governor-elect, I don't know if he's been sworn in today or not, but the incoming governor, Brad Little, signed that bill, that voter initiative, that passed the bill, Proposition 2, into law. That was my understanding. There's a lot to happen after that. What happens next? Do you foresee the legislature following through to implement this expansion? And there is some opposition. What do you see sitting here now, not being down there, but what you know about the legislative process to get this actually implemented?
Brother, excuse me. So I guess the proposition was passed by the people, the initiative process, and that puts it right into law. That was certified by the Secretary of State, and Governor Otter was out of state, so Lieutenant Governor, soon to be Governor, Brad Little, he gets sworn in January, signed it into law. So the process is now the Department of Health and Welfare has 90 days to put together a plan that needs to be submitted to the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. That shows how that will be implemented, what the components of those excuse me, services within that plan will be. At the same time, on a parallel track, the legislature's role is to fund, appropriate the 10% share. There's a match of funding, 90% from the federal government and 10% from the state government. So the legislature has to deal with funding and a piece of it, and then presuming that both those pieces go into place, then as of July 1st, the Medicaid expansion would be in place. And those that are in that gap, where they, it's basically the working poor, even if you, so, and I just rattled off, if you are a family of four, two parents and two kids, if you make over $5,200 and you don't get Medicaid, you're not able to get Medicaid, and you don't have any help on the insurance exchange until you make $24,300. And so access to health insurance is not there for those folks, and those are those that are in the gap that this will help. So the other thing that, couple things that are happening. So the legislature, it has the authority, the constitutional authority, to change laws, to write new ones, and to get rid of old ones. And so certainly it's within their prerogative to do something to this law. I believe that the legislative leaders, most of the legislative leaders, have publicly stated that they will support the will of the people. Many of the legislators also made similar pledges. Even if they were opposed, they would support the will of the people. And so I have confidence that they will keep their word. I do expect to see, that being said, I do expect to see a bill to repeal it. And I do expect to see the full implementation. And then I also expect something in the middle. And what does that mean? The legislature may try to tie some sort of work requirement strings or some other kind of strings. There are some in the legislature that worry about funding of abortions through Planned Parenthood. That's already not allowed, but it's an issue for some, and they may put that on the table. So I think you'll see a lot of grinding over different issues, but I am hopeful, as I support it, at the end of the day, that the legislators will keep their word and fund it. The funding is available. It's a rearranging of current funds, funds that we're using for indigent, or not indigent care, because that's at the county level, but catastrophic funding that is provided through the state level. We also have money from the tobacco settlements that can be redirected to this. And so that really, I think, will be the main focus, is the appropriations process and getting that funding through. There is a court challenge. The Idaho Freedom Foundation has challenged the constitutionality of the initiative language. The Supreme Court yesterday set a hearing date of January 29th with briefings by both sides due here next week. And so that's a fairly fast track for the Supreme Court. There are legal scholars that believe that the constitutionality question is a real long shot, and that the Idaho Supreme Court has ruled similar challenges out. So that's kind of the mix. I think because the Supreme Court dates not till the 29th of January, the session starts January 8th, that you won't see much movement. You'll see a lot of discussion until after the Supreme Court says something. So
that's my crystal ball. Yeah. As you kind of indicated, pretty good chance the Supreme Court will uphold the constitutionality of the...
That's what legal scholars are saying. Yeah. I am not an attorney, but the precedent seems to be there that the Supreme Court will uphold it. Mm-hmm.
Well, we just came fresh off an election, and we elected a successor to you for the first district Senate seat. That's Jim Woodward. Who you supported?
Yes.
In the race, as the old hand heading out the door, do you have any sage advice for Jim?
I think Senator Woodward is a very good person, and I think it's also important that folks understand. Yes, I supported him. I think he's a very good person. We don't always agree on things, but we do have civil discourse and civil. Conversations on those areas that we don't agree. My advice to Jim has been to stay in touch with people here at home and make an effort to communicate and meet with people. And my experience has been that through the campaigning and since Election Day, he has done exactly that. And I suspect he'll do that into the session.
So how does a elected person, especially when you're working down in Boise, how do you stay in touch with your constituents? And do you get a lot of emails and calls from constituents when you're down there?
Yes, I have experienced that, especially with the access of email these days, and which has been great. People do stay in touch, and they do call. More emails than calls these days. And so that will be, that is the major communication tool. I would encourage folks that even though emails are immediate, there were days when I would get 100 would be a minimum. And so it is physically impossible for a legislator to immediately reply. They try to, but it doesn't always happen. That being said, I saw every email that came in. So we do see it, and we do register it and put it into our input process. But email is the best way. There's also a message center that can be called. All of that's available through legislature.idaho.gov. And that's the key to staying involved.
Well, you are now retired, and you've had 22 years as being the elected official. How will you be as a constituent? How will you stay involved? How much interest will you probably take a little break and relax a bit? But, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, so the interest is still there, I'm sure. But how do you plan to stay involved?
Well, I am definitely, I definitely believe in being involved in our process, in our governmental affairs process, our government processes. Certainly the biggest way to be involved is voting. And I plan to continue to be involved in voting and in campaigns and supporting people that I believe would do a good job for us. And offering advice if I'm asked. Try not to give advice unless I'm asked for it. But and there are certainly issues that remain important to me that I will just as I hope every other citizen does, contact my legislators and let them know how I'm feeling about them. And I intend to continue to stay tuned and stay involved in those issues that are important to me and to my family and to those I think are important to our area as well.
One thing you've touched on and is so apparent in the political culture right now is the divisiveness and in polarization that's occurring nationally. We're certainly seeing it, and even locally here. So what do you think is the root cause of that? And how do you think we can find ourselves as a community past this time when when having different opinions seems to really tear people apart versus a time that we can remember when, yeah, we could talk these things over and work things out and occasionally find a compromise. Do you think we can get back to that?
Well, I remain hopeful. It has been very discouraging to me on a personal level to see a growing lack of civility and a desire to instantly go into personal attacks versus taking a deep breath and looking at the issue and talking about what the issue is in a civil manner and in a way that respects that the person across the table from you might have a different viewpoint, but that at a table where you can both put those perspectives out and talk about them politely and civilly. And I hope and would continue to work towards doing that. Unfortunately, it just seems like with social media and with the way some of our quote-unquote media sources have evolved, it's become okay to yell at each other. And that just... and talk over each other and call people names. And that is just very discouraging to me. And I think that each of us individually need to disown that form of communication and say, you know, this, it's too important. Our community, our state, our nation is too important to dissolve into this type of behavior. We need to step back and we need to be a part of turning our conversations into something constructive and productive. Maybe a little idealistic, but we have to get there, Chris, or it'll get worse.
There's individual responsibility here to look at our own behavior, our own kind of instinct to attack somebody. I think as you touched on, it's okay to oppose their idea or their opinion. It doesn't mean they're a bad person, though. It doesn't mean you have to impugn their integrity, and we've been seeing that.
Exactly.
And you came under fire, I think, as an elected person in that way as well. So I hope people will look and take a look at their own behavior in that way, and especially with social media. Pretty easy to hide behind some anonymous name and fire out, you know, inflammatory things about people.
Or even on Facebook, for example, you know, theoretically you have your own name out there. And even last night I'm reading comments that people are calling each other names. But because they're not in the same room with them, I think there's a sense of, well, I can say this. And I hope people think of themselves and say, now, is that something I would do if I was standing right in front of them? And if it was... why? And are we interested in solving issues? Are we interested in being constructive? Or are we interested in just destroying and tearing down?
Well, thank you very much, Sean Keogh. That great words of wisdom there. Less reactive, more responsive.
Exactly.
In a nice human way. We really appreciate your coming in. We could talk another couple hours, I have a feeling. But again, thank you for your 22 years of service to District 1 as our state senator. And it's always nice to speak with you. And thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thanks to the voters for allowing me the honor and privilege of serving all these many years. It really has been an honor. Thank you.
Just a few notes, and then we're going to hear a really great song that's appropriate. Thursday, tomorrow, December 6th, you can join Jim and Jack, morning show hosts, as they visit with Brenda Hammond from the Bonner County Human Rights Task Force. She'll be talking about a celebration on Sunday called the Human Rights Day, so you can tune in at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're really appreciate that you've been listening to the morning show. You can tune in again next week. We're going to have a recorded interview with the founders of Reclaim Idaho, just really celebrating what they worked so hard for also. So we're going to go out with a Beatles song. It's called We Can Work It Out. Have a great day.
Bye now.